two MLU insiders.
It's a sign of where Pitt is as an ultimate program.
Bringing you hard analysis of everything that happens on the field.
He's the best player on the field every time he steps on the field.
This is the John and Greg Show.
This is John Phillips here at the MLU offices. It's a beautiful day out here in Philadelphia. Lovely Tuesday afternoon. And with me, I have Greg Fallon.
Hello, John. How are you today?
Doing fantastic. You know, so Greg, last night, Jeff and Nick were nice enough, you know, gracious enough to bring you onto their show.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun. It was mostly because, as Nick said, they couldn't get anybody else.
Which is generally also we go about these things. You know, every week I'm like, man, I wish I had someone else that I could do this show with, but then it's just Greg here.
Yeah, so. I agree with you. I wholeheartedly agree. I'd rather you do the show with anyone else, but for some reason you keep getting me to do it. No, it was really good, mostly because Nick vowed that I would never be on his show, and I got on his show. But no, we had a nice chat. I think I was on for about 10 minutes. We had to plug the show. It asked me some questions about the season, about some players, and I think it was overall nice appearance.
But there's a little, you know, some
attempts. They were digging for some dirt.
Yeah, some attempts to, you know, make even more of a divide between us than there already is, Greg.
Yeah, it's a hate relationship here.
It is
between myself and John, and they tried to fuel the fire last night. They asked me who knew more about Ultimate. You or me? And of course I said I do, because what kind of expert would I be if I didn't think I was the smartest person in the room? And clearly you know nothing about Ultimate.
Right. Clearly Greg knows nothing, not just about Ultimate, but also,
which is why I don't want to do this show with you, because I'm so much more qualified than you.
Right. It makes me feel very awkward. It makes me feel very small that Greg just, you know, is so much more knowledgeable than I am. But, you know, going forward, We're going to test this.
We're going to see who knows more. We're going to have a friendly wager, I propose. Or we'll see at the end of the season who gets more game picks right. Maybe who gets more award picks right, depending on how many of the awards we actually predict become real awards.
Right. So that's our show tonight, working on awards. But
we did our all-league teams last week.
Yeah, which was
we talked about so much, we had to bump awards to this show.
Yeah, so get excited again. But over the course of the season, we'll make our picks, and depending on, you know, what awards are dished out at the end of the year, you know, we'll count up points, and
at the end of the season, one of us will win this friendly wager. But we really haven't decided what the bet is yet.
Right. So
we're gonna crowdsource it, like all good podcasts do when they can't come up with an idea. We want your ideas. What do you think the bet should be? And we'll take, you know, reasonable suggestions. You know, nothing crazy. No jogs around Center City in our underwear or anything like that. Right. But a nice, classy, friendly wager. And I have a couple ideas, but I'd like to see what other people think. And if somebody gives us a better one, I think we should go with it.
Yeah, for sure. I think that regardless, you know, just seeing Greg do anything because he loses this wager will be fun.
Well, don't get ahead of yourself. You still got to make these picks, John.
Well, yeah, so do you. So, you know, we're so close to the season. Like, I can feel it in my fingers.
It's really scary. I have so much work to do. It's not done.
So much work. And
we really shouldn't be doing this show. We should be working.
Probably not. But, you know, we had a great idea from you know, someone on Twitter, Play Alti, which, you know, has been a friend of the MLU since our inception last year on Twitter. Always very vocal about, you know, giving some critiques, giving, you know, some breakdowns of what's going on in the league. And one of his suggestions, which I love this. Yeah, you know, was to bring us into the fantasy fold.
Yeah, make us fantasy experts also. Which, you know, I don't know if I can get my Matthew Berry on every week, but let's try. Let's see if we can give some fantasy advice on the show. So, to the answer to your question, Play Alti is yes. We will do some fantasy tips on the show, and we'll put them on Twitter. You know, probably like an ad drop of the week if ad drop is added to fantasy this year. We have our team working really hard on that, trying to get fantasy up and running for you guys. So
right.
I'm excited to play this year. I'm excited for improvements this year in the fantasy experience. And we'll give you, you know, we'll give you advice. We'll tell you what we think about fantasy. Try to get you to win your league. So listen to this show if you want to win your league and beat your friends.
Right. So I think that'll be fun. That's another, you know, segment that we can break out every week, and it should
and
be fun.
Maybe, John, maybe you know, I've seen this on radio shows, sports talk radio shows. Maybe we do a fantasy league with the fans. Maybe we do our, you know, me and you against the first, let's say, what is it, a 10-team league sound good to you?
Yeah, I like that number.
The first 8 people who Twitter us to wanting to join the fantasy league, I think that's a verb, Twitter.
Yeah.
Tweet.
Twittering.
The first 8 people who tweet us that they want to be in the fantasy league, we'll try to get you signed up.
Yeah.
No multiple accounts. There's not a prize. It's just for fun.
Only for fun.
Just for fun.
Make us look bad. It sounds great to me.
Yep. Let's do it.
Yeah. So I mean, and then one more note that we're really excited about. That
I just got the email for this today. I'm very excited.
Yeah. So, you know, when you think of music, since for the, what, the last
really when you
10
think
years,
audio.
When you think audio, you know, you think iTunes. And finally, now your brain will be able to make another connection to iTunes. When you think of John and Greg's show, you should think of iTunes.
By the time this show airs, we will be on iTunes. We will provide a link to that on our social media pages.
Yep.
I got the email today that we've been approved, and we'll be on iTunes in a couple of hours. So you guys will be listening to this a couple of days after we record it, so we should be on iTunes.
Yeah,
if you haven't found it, if you're not on iTunes already, finding us, you can go and subscribe on iTunes if you're one of our Podomatic listeners. And, you know, hopefully this is a big step forward for us in terms of marketing ourselves.
Right. You know, I've been seeking approval in various realms of my life since I was a child. And, you know, finally, one thing's going right.
Yeah.
So that's great.
All right. We are going a little long here on the intro, so let's get it. We got a lot to cover today. We got a big show.
We did. So a quick rundown. You know, we're going to be making our picks of, you know, who we think will stand out in various categories. We're going to start off with, you know, East-West Rookies of the Year.
Yes, and just to clarify, as our good friend Sludge Brown pointed out in an article this week, about 50%, roughly 50% of MLU players this year will be rookies, and I'm using finger quotes for... I mean, those don't communicate well over microphone, but rookies, meaning their first year playing MLU, that's not what we mean by rookie for this award. It's, you know, we're looking at rookie in a more traditional sense, guys who are younger first year players, sort of closer to just coming out of college is what we use for the criteria for that award.
Yeah. And I love Sludge. He did really great work
there. Sludge is great.
And so that's the criteria that we're going to be using. It makes sense, we think.
Yeah, and let's move. We're also going to be doing our Defensive Player of the Year, which is an exciting award, I think.
Yeah, and one, you know, we got a little flack last week for, you know, the lack of, you know, talk about defensive players.
Yes, Morgan Hibbert said publicly that he likes you better than he likes me because you picked him for your all-league team. I told him Love is Coming, and, you know, that's what the Defensive Player of the Year award is for, because the way I think about pro is that the defense is important, but it pales in comparison to the importance of your offense. So it's nice that we're going to have an award on our show to, you know, recognize the guys who specialize on defense.
Right. Yeah, and so then we'll go to Coaches of the Year.
Yes, which is always a tough award.
It's tough.
In any sport, this is a tough award to call, and we're judging it on... Was that the doorbell? The doorbell just rang.
Yes, that was the doorbell.
Regroup. The Coach of the Year award for us is going to be the coach who we think is going to do the best in terms of managing talent and also recruiting talent, gathering talent,
right,
which is a big part of being a coach in this league, is not just game day, but also convincing guys to play for your team.
Right, and so we'll make those picks. We kind of see eye to eye on both of those.
Yeah.
And then we'll move to our MVPs, and you know, both of us
just
have...
always another tough way to categorize. It's, everybody has a different definition of MVP.
Right, and you know, we, even though we see fairly eye to eye on what MVP means, we don't necessarily see eye to eye on who the MVPs are on both.
This is gonna be, that's gonna be our probably most heated discussion this show.
Yeah, it will be, which it should be. And then, you know, a little treat at the end of the show.
You told me about this last week that you had set this up, and I'm just so excited. I love that we're going to do this.
Yeah, so we're bringing on Chris Mazur. We're talking to him pretty soon.
Our first guest. Big good friend of the show.
Yeah, like live as we record from New York, which will be really fantastic.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. I'm really excited for that. We're going to talk to him about a theory that I've come up with about the defensive handler to offensive handler
transition. The Fallon theory.
Of how classically defensive style handlers in club come into pro and they're playing offense and they're succeeding.
Right.
So we're going to get into that.
Yeah, so fantastic. Let's get right to it.
Yeah, we don't have a ton of time. I mean, this show seems to fly by. We can talk forever.
It really does. We can. So let's kick it off with Eastern Rookie of the Year.
Greg, this is a tough one because there's so many good young players coming in on the East. I mean, you could go Marquez Brownlee. You could go with some of the guys in Philly, the Pitt kids, Max Thorne, Pat Earls, those guys, Marcus Rennie Dropcho, great big names.
Yep.
You could even go up to Boston and talk about Jeremy Nixon, who's a stud from Harvard that's coming out to the Whitecaps this year. He's going to be a nice player.
Yeah, he looks great.
But for me, it's Isaac Saul, because I think he's going to bring more than just talent. I think he's going to bring that winning attitude we talk about so much. I mean, he's won at every single level he's ever played at, high school, you know, youth worlds, whatever, college. Now he's coming into pro, and it's going to be his first season. And for him, he's like the most traditional rookie we have in that he just graduated college.
Yeah.
Very successful back-to-back national champion.
True.
Coming into the pros outside of his home city, which is interesting. So I think that he's going to make a big difference for them, and he's going to give them a nice boost. He's going to be the rookie of the year in the East.
I like Isaac Saul a lot. I've enjoyed talking to him, you know, when we were up at the combine. I love that he made a move playing somewhere else. I think that says so much about what he's looking for.
And what Anthony Nunez has been able to do with that roster.
Right, and we're going to talk about Anthony later and what he's going to be able to do going forward. You know, but for me, before I made my original pick, I had Cody Johnston for D.C., down. But then last weekend I was procrastinating all the things that I should be doing with my life, like getting a job, you know, amongst other things.
We have jobs.
You know, I need money, Greg. I'm currently on financial hold to graduate college. It's a problem.
Okay, John, you should stop recording. You should go and get an extra job.
So, you know, but I was watching Pitt at Easterns, and I was watching Marcus Rauchy drop show, and that... all those guys. And he's fantastic.
I was watching the same game, actually. And I saw you tweeting about it. I didn't want to, you know, interrupt you watching it. But he was very impressive. And I think he's going to be a nice addition. I thought Max Thorne was going to be the biggest get out of that group. But that guy, since Nationals last year, has really just come on, burst onto the scene. And he's looking like another, maybe like Tyler DiGirolamo Light.
Yeah.
From Pittsburgh last year.
Yeah, it's just about stature. And I think that, you know...
He's a lot taller than I thought he was.
Yeah, yeah. He's...
You take DiGirolamo off the field, everybody seems to look a little bit taller than they used to.
Right, right. Very true. But, you know, he stands out. Thorne's great, too. And Earls, all of them. And we can't...
Earls has that lefty... I don't know what the word I'm looking for. But being a lefty...
It helps. It's an advantage. It
throws some defenses off.
It totally does, and, you know, they're fun to watch. I've loved being able to check them out.
They play really hard, too. They play really hard with really a lot of confidence. There's a system there.
Right.
You can see there's a system.
Yeah, there's definitely a system in place, and with Jonah, too, Jonah playing their D-line, he's playing fantastic, too.
So you're going with Marcus Rennie Dropcho for your Eastern
rookie. I'm going with Marcus.
Okay.
You know,
so we're both picking Pitt kids, just in different cities. I like this.
Which is fun. I mean, it's a sign of where Pitt is as an ultimate program.
Well, let's move to the West.
Yep.
Why don't you start with this one?
Yeah. I'll kick this one off. So my explanation for this West pick, even though, you know, this player is not a rookie per se, he is coming over from a different country.
Okay, so you're going more with like the European basketball player, like the Yao Ming rookie or the Yu Darvish rookie.
Yeah.
Or Daisuke Matsuzaka, which is one of my favorite names in sports.
Daisuke.
I'm not quite a baseball guy.
Daisuke is super fun. yeah, and so I'm going with Takuya Saito.
Interesting pick.
And so
interesting interpretation of rookie.
It is an interpretation of rookie, and I understand that full well. This is also me not knowing.
I think this is acceptable just because they have this style of rookie in other sports.
And the reason that I think that he will change, you know, it's about like having a culture shock, right? There's always a shock from college to the pros, and in this case, it's going from, you know, a different style of play with the buzz bullets to coming over here, playing with a wider field.
Yeah, which, you know, I think he's going to love. I think he's just going to thrive in that system.
Yeah, and so, like, he has big, you know, cutters alongside him, you know, guys who can rule the air.
He's on the hot pick team.
Everybody
seems to be picking those guys.
He is, and so I think that he's going to be a real impact player for them, and he's my pick, as untraditional as it may be.
Well, I'm going back to the traditional route. For a guy from University of Oregon coming into the Portland Stags. I mean, there's two guys from the Portland Stags that you can really pick, and both would be justified. But I'm going with Camden Allison Hall. You put him on your all-league team, I think.
I did. He's a good player.
We're both high on him. We both think that he's going to be a big, big addition for that team. He's super fast. He's played on this big field with refs before when he played against the Philadelphia Spinners with Next Gen while he was still in Oregon.
Right.
I love everything he brings. I think he comes from a good college program, as do a lot of those guys in the Stags. And I think we've both predicted they're going to have a better year. You think they're going to the playoffs. I'm not so sure. I think that's a stretch for them this year. But I did pick him to be the most improved team, and one of those reasons is Camden Allison Hall.
So
moving on to our DPOY,
the
Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah. So yeah. This is...
Ick and Jeff last night asked me about, you know, who I think is going to be... who's going to produce the best highlight this year. Huh. And that would be my Eastern Defensive Player of the Year, Delrico Johnson.
Right.
And I had a little bit of a panic moment for a second when I was looking at the rosters before the show.
You told me about this. This is funny.
We had a slight roster input error where Delrico Johnson was left off the DC roster on the website. That's, I think, since been corrected. I alerted the team of it when I saw it. I actually called the GM. I was like, Matt, did Delrico not make the team? And he's like, no, he's on the team. I was like, yes, you do. He's my Defensive Player of the Year pick. I mean, he's just the most exciting defender in the Eastern Conference. He's the most athletic. He's always laying out. He's always close to the disc for Ds. And also on the turn, he's an explosive cutter deep. So I like what he brings as a defensive specialist, and he has the two best highlights, I think, from last year. Obviously, his catch in the de facto playoff game in week 10.
Oh, yeah.
And
what a great catch.
The play where he basically jumps over Trey Katzen back in week 1, which I wish had a call on it, but it does not. That was before I had become the de facto voice of the DC Current last year. Those of you who recognize my voice, that's where you may recognize it from. I called some of the DC Current games.
Greg is a little famous down in D.C.
I'm super famous now on iTunes, man.
Very true. Yeah, so, I mean, I love Delrico. I think that he's definitely the walking highlight reel that, you know, we look for, you know, especially for you as a video guy.
Oh, I love it. I love watching Delrico play.
Yeah, so he's great. And I think that there are a few guys on that D-line that are going to make huge impacts.
It's an impressive line.
It really is.
Which is great considering how impressive their O-line is.
Right. You can say that about both D.C. and New York.
Yeah.
That, like, absolutely. You look at those D-lines and you're like, Boston. Oh, wow. Well,
although I have a couple of guys on Boston's D-line. I think losing Will Neff is a big deal.
It is.
He's the leader of that D-line, but I still think it's a very strong D-line. Their O-line is the best in the league, I think, but their D-line is also very good. They have some guys, Teddy Bruyarjaris, John Hirschberger, who I think you're going to talk about.
I am going to talk.
I saw on your screen over there.
I am.
So let's get your pick here.
Yeah. So I think that Boston, in a lot of ways, you know, they're successful on O, obviously, but their defense is also really strong. And so, you know, you talk about losing Will Neff. That's very true.
Yeah.
But one of the things that happens with Boston is, you know, they get up on teams, and then what they're able to do is when teams start pushing, late in games, they're able to take advantage. And John Hershberger is a big reason why. In terms of his abilities, not just as a defensive player, but when he has a disc in his hands on D trying to convert breaks, he is smooth and he gets the job done.
I strongly considered Hershberger. I also considered the other guys from the Boston D-line, Teddy Bergeron being one of them, but
Hatchett,
great player. But I'm just landing on Del Rico because I think when I think of a great defensive player, I think of a guy who makes big plays, especially in this league where you don't get as many chances,
right,
to make, you know, spectacular defense. There are more turnovers, but it's still high level ultimate with very good offenses. So there's less turnovers than say in your local pickup game, and you got to earn a lot of these D's.
Right, and that's true. I think that this is about, you know, the way that I think about defenses. If and I was never this effective as a defensive player. Like, I've always been a guy that lines up on the D line, but you know, my guy would always get the disc. It would be that, like, after that first cut in,
you're the control type of defender, not the splashy,
right,
the big play. Unless you're the guy who doesn't want to get scored on.
Unless it's late,
which
in the
is
game.
The way that I play defense. Also,
right. Unless it's late in the game and I just turn the disc on O, yeah. I think that if you look at where my D's come from in my playing career, they're immediately after I make a terrible play on O.
I have a great amount of respect for guys who are spectacular defensive players because I've been an offensive player my entire career,
right,
which I'm very grateful for. Thank you, coaches and captains.
Yeah, that's my biggest regret in high school. I never threw a disc because I didn't have to. I just played D.
Yeah, it's not a good way to learn how to play ultimate.
It really isn't. And then I got to college, and it was problematic.
Yeah.
So that's fun. But Hershberger is that type of control D guy. And so he's...
So you're picking him more because of his ability after the turn. His ability to just be consistent.
Yeah.
Whereas Del Rico and big defenders like that will get scored on, but they're going to come up with big plays for you.
Right. And Del Rico, you saw his value last year.
A huge impact. He makes a huge impact on the game. And there's a vastly greater number of turnovers in pro than club. But it's still hard to get a turnover. I mean, I guess especially against a team like Boston, who's a machine on offense. They just go down and score.
Right.
You really, if you want to get a D and you want to... You know, teams will give you turnovers sometimes on deep throws and things like that. But if you want to get a turnover, it's going to have to be a spectacular play. Or you have to force a mistake.
Right.
So the impact of a guy who can make big plays like that, I think, is huge.
Yeah, no, and you know, it's about different philosophies. But
and now we move to
in
the West.
Yeah,
where
in the West.
We have a very similar type of player.
Right.
Who we both picked for the defensive player.
We did.
Good friend of the show.
Yeah, he is a friend of the show. I like that. Friend of me, more
than
you.
Very active. Yeah. As he said publicly. But he said he still likes me.
Well, that's nice. I mean...
He's a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
I love this guy.
He's Canadian.
He's great. He's Canadian. So he can only come from one team. let's cut the suspense. It's Morgan Hibbert.
It is Morgan Hibbert.
There you go, Morgan. There's the love. You're not on my all-league team, but you're my Western Conference Defensive Player of the Year. So, and you're also John's.
Yeah.
Because he copied off of me.
I didn't actually copy off of him. I was saying that he's Canadian, which makes him nice. But, you know.
Hey, he's a great defender.
He's
got some, from the few games he was healthy for last year, there's some plays that he makes where he's just jumping over the backs of people and making incredible plays to, you know, get the disc back for his team. There's one I remember where I forget who he's guarding, but it looks like, you know, the guy's 5 yards ahead of him. He closes and then kind of just gets over the top of him with his hand. It doesn't foul him and just knocks the disc away. It's a great play.
You know, he's athletic, but more than that...
He's very smart. He's been doing this a while.
Yeah, he's brilliant. And he also has fun, which I think can't be...
Yeah,
you know,
when you think Western Conference defense, you think Morgan Hibbert. So I don't think there was really any other pick here. Provided he's healthy. If he's not healthy, he's not going to be the defensive player either. But if he's healthy, I think he's on a team that... You know, looks to be a lot better this year. He's going to be a big contributor.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we talk about how everyone's jumping on the Nighthawks right now. I think that he's a big reason why, knowing that he's healthy and that he's going to be able to lead that D-line effectively.
There's no question about it. That team was hampered by injuries a lot last
year. It really was. We talk about how Seattle was riddled with injuries, and like that kind of became the narrative.
Seattle was a deeper team, though. Vancouver wasn't quite as deep.
Exactly.
I think a healthy Vancouver team this year is going to be very strong.
Yeah,
and Morgan Hibbert is a big key to that.
Right.
Especially on defense. The same reason Dorico Johnson's a key for D.C.
It's a shame that Vancouver, we kind of think about them, their three wins are against Portland, and it kind of looks like they just weren't a very good
team. But they were so close in those games. I mean, right. They had leads on San Francisco and Seattle, even with the injuries.
Yeah, and I think
late in the fourth quarter. And right. I think they led Seattle by, five goals or something.
Oh, twice. Some ridiculous.
Twice. Yeah. In consecutive games, they blew a five-goal lead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those things where... if they had all their players healthy,
yes,
all their big guys, those games would have been differently. They would have gotten a few more
now
wins.
Now we're moving on to our coach of the year. We agree in both coasts.
Yeah, which, they're only, unlike all these other categories where there are a lot of
there's guys, a lot of choices. There's eight choices, and you got to pick two of them. So
right, whereas
here... we had a pretty good shot of being in agreement.
Yeah, and here it's not so much about, figuring out, who to pick out of, this wide sea of players, but it's instead, who looking intricately at what a coach has done so far to set his team up.
And it's not the coach that's going to win the league. It's not the coach that's going to... A lot of times, coach of the year is given to the coach who makes the biggest improvement in his team mm-hmm. from the year before.
Right.
And usually, the new coach that makes the biggest improvement
yeah.
in his team. We can't really look at it that way. We have to look at, the best... The guy who's going to do the best coaching job. And we had to define what a coaching job was.
Right.
So, with that in mind, on the East... we're going with, oddly enough, the new guy who we expect a big improvement in the team from,
yes.
in Anthony Nunez, who's
yeah.
taken over for Daniel Quaranta. And so far, he's off to a great start if you look at his roster. Just that's why he's the coach of the year for me, because he's already brought in with his connections through all of his years of coaching youth, coaching high school, coaching college. He's brought in so many really, really strong players from... not necessarily out of town. Well, some from far out of town and some from, not so far out of town.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that he gives off, this kind of quiet confidence that I appreciate in that, a lot of this work that he's been doing to set this season up, it's been happening for a long time. And he understands yeah. the long game. He understands playing, talking to Mazur in November and December and talking to Ben Faust
and he's
talking to all those leaders.
So many key players from last year. I don't think that team really lost a guy other than Rob Baker, who I think moved very far away. I can't think of a guy that New York didn't bring back that they really, really needed to bring back.
Right. Yeah. And I think that...
We saw at the tryout some good players there that did not make this team. There are some really, really good players that got cut from this team. They're just so much better, and I think a lot of that has to do with Anthony Nunez. And not that Daniel Quaranta did a bad job. He would have been my pick for, Coach of the Year in the East last year as well. But so far, Nunez off to a great start.
Yeah, and again, you look down in Philly, and we'll have to wait and see. I can't pick Billy.
Just with all the rumblings so far about what system they're going to play, I'm just not
You can't really do it, and the joke that I made originally when I was thinking about Coach of the Year, I said, well, I can't give this to Jeff Graham, because, talking
about... I believe a lot in Sam Rosenthal. I think from everything I've heard, it's going to, he's a strong coach.
Mm-hmm.
Jason Adams did a nice job last year, obviously taking his team to an undefeated championship.
Yes.
But the roster's loaded. It's almost Eric Spoelstra syndrome, where, give me LeBron, Bosh, and Wade, and just don't screw it up.
Right.
There's obviously coaching in that city is going to be important, and I'm sure Sam's a fantastic coach, but I'm not putting him over Nunez. I think Nunez is going to do a better job this year, even if he doesn't win the East.
Right, but, I think that a few players, looking at rosters, on Boston, hopefully... for them, they feel a little bit like there's a chance that New York could challenge them. I think that could be beneficial.
Yeah.
To them. New York.
And that's
and
where Sam Rosenthal's job's gonna come in.
Right.
But let's move on to the West, where we also agree.
Yeah. So
I'll let you take this one.
Yeah, so last year the pick would be the same because if you know Justin Safdie, you know what a strong, you know, presence he is, not only during games, but over the course of the entire process. And last year, he just had to deal with different lineups running out there every
single week. It seemed like there was a different Dogfish team, and they were able to win 8 games in the regular season. And they really, they lost the back end of a back-to-back against Portland without most of their best players, and then they lost a game to Seattle that meant literally nothing. It was a practice game.
Right. Yeah, and so I think that he's, you know, in your notes you had down that he's the best mind in the MLU.
He absolutely is the best coach in the MLU. Just pure coaching ability. I mean, he's the best at managing talent.
Yeah, and this year he'll have to do it.
He puts his players in the best position to succeed. And with a massive roster turnover in San Francisco, he's got his work cut out for him. But I was talking to Jeff Snyder, who was out talking to Justin Safdie a couple weeks ago, and he said with complete confidence, 100% confidence, that he still has the best team. He's really high on some of the guys he brought from the Santa Barbara area. He's really high on, you know, the returners and some of the guys who were lesser known on the Dogfish roster last year. If he says he's still got the best team, I'm not going to tell him he doesn't.
No, not at all.
Because I think he's just going to do a great job putting the guys in the position to succeed.
Yeah, and so another shout out to Sludge, you know, on his graphics on rookies, so new players.
They have
on
the highest percentage of rookies, right? 70% of their roster?
Yeah. So 70%, I mean, if you, the really shocking thing is that the amount of new players on the Dogfish and the Rainmakers, they're at 70% and 66% respectively.
Yeah.
The third highest is 46% with the Rumble. So
who added to the top.
Right. They added great.
That's
players.
46% at the top of the roster.
You know, whereas the Dogfish and the Rainmakers are building up. You know, they're building from, you know, the
we
bottom.
We assume.
We haven't seen those players.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't.
I'm sure there's going to be some superstars from those teams that we have not heard of ever.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. And that's definitely true.
Justin Safdie is going to be one of the big reasons that those guys, that we know those names later.
Yeah. I mean, 30 roster players and 70% of them.
All right. Yeah. We're running out of time on this segment, so we got to get to the big award, the most valuable player.
Yeah, so we'll start in the
this
East.
Is the one everybody wants to know. We got to give a shout out to Mark Evangelisto, sent us some picks. He sent us, not surprisingly, two of his own players awards.
Not too surprising.
He sent us Cody Johnston for his rookie of the year, and for his MVP, he picked Peter Pryle, which is a guy I certainly think is in the race. I certainly think he's going to have a great year. But my pick in the East is the easiest pick I've ever made, Jeff Graham. There's no... Who else makes sense? I'm sure you have a different pick. I have stars next to him on my sheet, which means you picked someone else.
Yes.
And I think, no. Just no. You're not right. I mean, Jeff was the MVP last year, by my estimation, as... I don't want to take anything away from Chris Mazur because he had a great season and he certainly was a deserving MVP. But my vote would have gone to Jeff Graham with Chris second. And I think he's the best player on the field every time he steps on the field. So who else can you pick?
You know, I have hesitations about Graham just in terms of, you know, whether he'll be able to stay healthy. I think last year in the laning weeks.
Which is that's not the preseason awards. We're picking regardless of injury right now. You're taking it.
I disagree. Okay. I think that, you know, the reason that he didn't win that award last year was because he wasn't playing at week one strength.
I disagree. I think the reason he didn't win the award was because there's so many guys on Boston that took votes away from each other.
That's true. And Marquette will do the same thing this year.
I don't think so. I think another year of watching Jeff Graham play, people are not going to vote for anybody else.
That may be true. And I think that's the logical choice.
Nobody else makes sense to me at this point.
Yeah. So
certainly Chris Mazur and Peter Pryle worthy to talk about in this, but I think they're a step below.
I think that Pryle on DC and Kolek potentially, depending on like numbers and how that offense works. Numbers wise, I don't know. New York, I have hesitations about picking Chris Mazur, but that's who I'm picking. I look at, you know, he's currently running and getting a sandwich, so we have a little bit of time
before he comes on the show.
So you know, he is the leader of that team. I think when you look at the amount of new players that he's going to have to integrate, it's on his shoulders because he is the best player on that team,
and he's the reigning MVP. So you're taking with the easy choice. You're taking a guy to repeat.
You know, I think that Graham's the easy choice. I'll be honest. I think that. If it's the no-brainer, then that's the...
Yeah, I think it is.
But
you know, you're sticking with the guy who's already won it.
I am, but I think that this season it's much different. Like, the stakes are higher. And
stakes are much... There's a lot of pressure on the team, too.
There's a ton of pressure, and this is only going to add to it.
Largely put on them by us.
Right.
So, Chris has given us some flack about that, but I'm sure he'll chew us out when we have him on in a few minutes.
Yeah, so this is only going to add to that. And I apologize for that. But I do think that if this team that I really believe in to challenge Boston, if they're going to do it, then Mazur deserves to get props for that.
I mean, as much as I love Jeff, I don't want to be right about this pick because I think it's more interesting if somebody else is the MVP.
Right. Whether it be Peter, whether it be a Philly guy.
Yeah.
Out of the woodwork.
I would love for Mazur to win it again because he's one of my favorite players to watch and one of my favorite guys to root for in the league. But I think it's Jeff. I think it's Jeff Graham. And if it's not Jeff Graham, it's whoever Jeff Graham says it is.
I think that's how we should determine the pick.
When I was on Cleats and Cufflinks last night, they asked me who I thought was going to score the most goals. I was like, well, whoever Jeff Graham lets score the most goals.
Jeff Graham is as the puppeteer of this entire league.
Jeff Graham's just the commissioner. This is all an elaborate ruse run by Jeff Graham.
That doorbell again.
It's a busy day. Usually we don't record this early in the day, so... We're getting some background noise today.
Yes, you know, so I disagree with you. I think it's I believe in Mazur. I do. I think that if anything, that like if New York makes a run at it, like someone on that roster, I don't know exactly who, will make a run and pull votes away from Mazur the same way that, you know, Marquette without Pryle, that also helps Graham.
We've got about 2 minutes left on the segment, so let's get into our West MVP.
Yeah, so
we picked similar guys.
Yeah, so we both picked San Francisco guys. Mine is more of a reach. Yours, again, is...
A proven commodity.
It's a proven commodity. I'm going to go first, just because I think...
Neither of us picking Adam Simon, by the way. The reigning MVP. Yeah. So we're going different here.
I think that the reason that you don't pick Simon is just because...
The talent around him is not what it was last year.
His numbers just won't be as good. And, like, as much of a great leader as he is, I can't see it. Yeah, you know, so I'm going with Mac Taylor.
Who, if he plays every game, I think is going to be a huge, huge addition. Just a huge player.
So
I mean, he was on the team last year, but playing more games will help.
We talk about, you know, I made the speculation that if, you know, Graham makes it through the season healthy, you know, in the same way.
I still think that Evan Boucher will be the MVP.
Right.
His teammate, regardless of how many games Mac plays. But I think, you know, you've got a strong case. With Mac Taylor. He's a great player, and he'll certainly be in the discussion if he plays every game.
So, Mac Taylor, just a few, you know, facts, right? So 26% of the throws that... 22, sorry, I didn't update that number. 22% of the throws that he made last year that he completed went for scores.
That's an impressive number.
Which is just... It's just silly.
One in five times he touches the disc, he throws a goal.
That's just silly. So if he plays every game, I don't want to know what his numbers will look like. This is a team that puts the disc. They love that. And he'd be the one doing it. So I can't help but think that his numbers will be monstrous.
And I'm not really picking Evan for numbers. I think it's just his impact all over the field. You know, there's no distractions this year with, you know, Team USA coming and going. There's no one to take the spotlight off of him this year. People are going to have a front row seat to watch Evan Boucher play. And you're going to get to see he's the best player out there. Best player on the Dogfish, and you're just gonna get to watch him go dominate games, which is the quality we've been talking about with Evan Boucher for the last few weeks. He just goes out and dominates. It's not the numbers, it's the impact, which is why I think he's gonna be the Western MVP.
I think it'll be interesting to see this all, you know, this all comes back to Safdie in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
And just like, if this team is going to be, you know, the 7-3 squad that we imagined, 8-2, 7-3, yeah, then it has to be on one of these guys' backs. And so it's logical to pick a guy from San Francisco. I don't know exactly. In the East Coast, you can say, like, yeah, for Washington, it would be Peter. Yeah. You know, it would be Peter Pryle. But on the West Coast, it's a little more hazy. Like, Adam Simon would be the guy you pick from Seattle, but you don't feel good picking him.
Yeah, not right now. He's easily the best player on the team right now, I think. But, you know, we haven't seen a lot of their roster, so the West is very hazy. So we're both going with guys who we know are very good, and I think we just see the race differently.
Yeah, and good friends, they will make each other better.
Yeah, you could really just say the MVP would be Mac Boucher or Evan Taylor.
Or Evan Taylor. I'm not sure which name I like more.
I don't know.
You know, which...
Or McEvan Taylor Boucher. Or McEvan Taylor Boucher.
Love it. I think that's our MVP.
Yeah, there we go.
And our world champions.
And with that, we wrap the award segment. Yeah. Chris Mazur coming up next on the John and Greg Show.
So we promised you him a little earlier in the show, and here he is in the flesh.
In the voice, actually.
In the voice. In the flesh. Flesh is
he's
stuff.
In the flesh for us. He's not in the, why he's in the screen.
Why don't you try that one again?
So we have,
take it from the top.
We have Eastern Conference MVP in 2013, Chris Mazur, with us from the New York Rumble. Chris,
our first guest.
Our first guest. Greg Show. It's great. And Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm great, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah.
Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, we're super excited to have
really
you.
I get really sick of just talking to John for an hour.
I get sick of being with me too, Greg, so I'm sorry. So, you know, we want to talk to you a little bit today about, you know, what we coined a little earlier in the show, the Fallon theory.
The Fallon theory, yeah. Which is my theory that I came up with myself.
Yeah.
Proud of you. I noticed a lot of guys who are traditionally defensive handlers in club, usually guys who have strong, deep throws. And four examples that we've come up with are you, Chris, Brandon Malachek from Boston, Markham Schaffner in D.C., and to an extent, Dave Bear in Philly.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys usually play defense, and the risk-taking deep thrower has been traditionally a defensive position in Ultimate. And now we're in Pro, and you guys have all switched to offense and are like four of the best offensive players in the league. So that's an interesting transition, and we'd really like to get your thoughts on what that's been like and why you think that is. I have some theories of my own, but I'd like to hear what you think first.
Sure. I'd say there's a couple of pieces to that. I mean, yeah, I think we all, at least the first three guys that you mentioned, have a lot of fun throwing it as far as possible at any opportunity that we have. And so that's why we get that, like, gunslinger reputation, I suppose. I believe we've all been pullers for teams in the past too. I know I remember in college watching Muffin pull, and that guy was just ridiculous. And I was some like no name kid from another college who couldn't even go to regionals. So I just like tried to throw as far as I could and thought I was cool for that. Why are we successful? It's just the field size that makes sense, right? I mean, you're trying to throw it 80 yards. Sometimes, and if you can stretch the field just a little bit more, you don't always have to throw at 80 yards. You can just have the threat of that being there, which is that I read a really cool article about how throwers can change the game just by putting more pressure on the defense to respect angles. So you don't always have to be making risky 50-50 decisions that are really long passes. It's a matter of it just being an option so that all of the underneath throws end up being easier. And while I'd say, you know, at least Muffin and I were in the top of the league in terms of turnovers, I forget about Schaffner and Dave Bear. I think we all would rather throw the disc away a whole lot less. So I'd hope that being on the field, at least for myself personally, it's just a matter of you know, helping my teammates get open a little easier if they can, you know, get open on an in cut, because one step to the deep means they have to be respected for going deep. then, you know, I'm happy to throw a 10-yard gainer.
So you're talking about the field being wider is a reason that the deep looks are more prevalent, considering, you know, you don't have to hit, you can throw 80 yards, but you don't have to hit such a thin target. You have a wider area to throw too deep. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's also just that it's 80 yards long, so we have an extra 10 yards of depth. But yeah, the swing passes too. I mean, that, like, anybody who likes to throw over the top with a hammer. I mean, you saw Muffin destroy a couple hammers last year that were just like filthy cross field, 35 yards across, and then also, you know, 50 yards down. And so, like, that's so dangerous and nearly impossible to guard. I mean, just because there's all that width, as long as well as having length on the field too.
We found an interesting stat actually that lends itself to this, that the two teams that played in the championship, I don't know if you've heard of this stat yet, but the two teams that played in the championship had the least and the most turnovers in the league. San Francisco turned the disc over more than anybody else. A significant amount more, too. I think it was like four or five more a game.
Yeah.
That's because the defense out west was stellar.
Yeah. The thing that we found was that they prefer to turn the disc over way, way further down the field, which is why Philly struggled. They turned the disc over behind themselves, really giving people short fields. So riskier play we found has been encouraged in pro as opposed to club. And you're always playing a good defense, so teams don't really worry as much about the turnovers.
Yeah.
Chris, how many of the turnovers that you personally had last season would you say were on Hucks versus, you know, some of those like kind of more detrimental turnovers?
Ooh, great question. I can't remember specifically off the top of my head. I remember very vividly turfing the disc on an in cut for Dan Heyman in week two against Philly when it mattered most. So I can tell you I had that one. I don't think I'll forget about that ever. It's got to be like probably like 65 to 70% of my turnovers must have been on throws over 50 yards. I mean, it's got to be. I can't remember really hurting us terribly bad with like messing up on a dump set or something. Right. Besides like one or two specific moments, for the majority of the time, it was certainly on deep throws.
Yeah, I mean, I just asked because one of the cool things that we've had someone do at the office here is like break down that championship game. You know, every throw is broken up either into, you know, dump, short, medium, and long range.
In like 10 to 20 yards, 20 to 40 yards, 40 plus, and then the dump, which we made a negative yardage throw. There were zero negative yardage turnovers in the championship game.
Yeah, that's cool.
Which just speaks to the way that those guys play.
Right.
I mean, they don't mess up in the backfield, but they mess up a ton down the field, and I think they're okay with that. And that's, I think, where my theory comes from, is that there are more turnovers in pro, but the downfield turnovers are what we would, I guess, say are good turnovers.
Yeah.
So the riskier play is encouraged. And the other thing is you got to be able to play defense on the turn in pro. Like, you can't afford to keep your best players on the bench. So you can't keep a guy like a Malachek,
right,
like you, like Schaffner. You can't keep them on the bench on defense for the whole game because you're not going to get the maximum effect out of them. You're playing a single game format, so you're not saving anybody for the rest of the weekend. You're saving people for the rest of the game. And also, the defenses are better because they have a week to prepare for one team in one matchup. And there's film on it.
Right.
So that's, I think, true. All of this combines to create an environment where there's more turnovers. And when there's more turnovers, you get to play a little riskier. And you get to shoot it deep. And, you know, guys who shoot it deep seem to be having some success.
Sure, but let's also make this clear. I don't think, and this is where I'll disagree with you, I don't think that any of these guys that we're talking about, myself included, are close to the top 10 players in the league.
Really?
I think that we're just on the field in that position because we help the dominant cutters downfield do their job, and we're just trying to feed it to them. I mean, just because we are capable of throwing it a little bit farther, we're put into a situation where the disc is in our hands and it looks like it's really our decision and our ability that's getting done. But we're doing one thing. We're throwing it really far. Whatever. We're not that good compared to everyone else. So guys like Jeff Graham, really creative guys like Cricket, those are the real guys that, man, they were the real MVPs of the East Coast last year. I mean, I don't know what the voters were smoking last year, but I don't know. That's just my opinion. I mean, guys like Shocker and Malachek just open up the field so much that the real studs on the field are making plays.
That's an interesting take on it.
That's an interesting take. I mean,
we tend to highly value the handler position. I mean, I'm biased because that's the position I play myself. So I'm
not biased because I'm not a handler in any respects.
I always enjoy watching handlers more. I guess playing the position, I have a little bit more appreciation for it. But that's interesting that you have a different take.
Sure. Yeah. I think the most valuable players on the field are defensive cutters. I mean, you can't have enough good defensive cutters, and those guys, if they can get a stop on someone that's really, really good, and give you a chance to get a break, I think that's huge.
That explains why you and Morgan Hibbert are such good friends on Twitter.
Yeah, right? Yeah, Morgan's a beast.
Yeah.
I would love to get to go out there and play some of the West Coast teams. That'd be a lot of fun.
Maybe you'll get to see him in Philly. Who knows? Maybe you guys will meet.
Yeah, that'd be a dream. Yeah, that'd be a little dream
matchup. I wouldn't mind watching that matchup.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
How about, like, with DC, you know, we talk about Schaffner, but, you know, Alan Kolick, he's another one where he touches the disc a ton.
He's more of the traditional offensive player, though.
He is. Oh, no, I'm saying that, like, would you put him closer to Graham and Cricket in terms of, you know, the more standard player in what they're able to do?
Yeah, man, he does it all. I mean, he actually has every throw in the book and does it with both hands with such consistency that you have to game plan for him. I mean, you have to. Because he changes the game completely. When he's not on the field, DC is a different team. When he's on the field, DC is extremely dangerous, and you have to play straight up and honest on every other player on the field because he just throws guys open in a way that very few other players in the country can do it.
So
he's also virtually unguardable after he throws it.
Right.
He's so good with, and this is something I learned from him, and it's improved my game a lot, that he's already moving when he's throwing, and he tries to throw his backhand as much as possible because it's easier for him to run off of a backhand than a flick. And there's that clip where a really good defender from Boston is covering him. I think it was Chris Waite. I'm not exactly sure. Maybe Eric Stevens. I'm not sure exactly who it was. But somebody is covering him, and after about three throw and goes, you see him look to somebody and point, like, cover this guy, I'm done.
Yeah, if you don't step on his wizard's cape, like, he's getting away from you.
Yeah.
I like that.
That's a good way to put it.
So, moving to, you know, your team and the way that your offensive handlers at least have been assembled. So, knowing that you can stretch the field, what has been your thought process? What has been Anthony Nunez, coach of the New York Rumbles, thought process in, you know, getting you other guys that surround you who are able to do other things on the field to give you as much of a varied attack as possible?
Sure. I think we wanted the depth in throwers just because we as a team turned it over way too much last year, and we valued possession way much more than the staff would ever show. So having extra handlers is really key, and it would also allow us to get the best out of each player's ability. So we're not taking a guy just because he happens to be the best option we have as a reset handler, but he actually really excels in doing something else. You know, like we were kind of stuck in some situations where we were like kind of pressed for, I don't want to say talent, but like pressed for guys that could do certain jobs without trying to give away too much strategy that I don't want to. But just like getting the most out of a player's ability. So like a guy like Sean Murray, is a stud, right? I mean, you guys have been talking about him. You know, we always had to deal with playing against him.
Yeah.
And he's a guy that can do it all. You know, he's got all the really good throws and he can cut downfield. But he's really like a strong defensive cutter. You know, like he can play that position really well because he's really smart and sees the field really, really well. And because of that, he makes the rest of the guys around him better. And so I think Philly ended up using him a lot on offense last year because he brings some offensive firepower. But I think we're deep enough in offensive cutter where we can actually use his best ability, which is being a defensive cutter, and getting a lot out of them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot on the show about how deep your team looks and the scary, scary lineups you guys could stick out there on offense. And we've talked about if Murray's on offense, that's really scary, but you guys are going to be deep enough that you can shift him back to defense.
Exactly. You know, we're hoping you get started by, you know, offensive handler. You know, I'd love to go pull again. That'd be so much fun. That's a question I wanted to ask you guys. Can the MVP award be won by a defensive player?
Greg's going to say no. I already know Greg's answer.
I don't think they're on the field enough. I don't think they have the disc enough. But I'd love to be proven wrong. As I've said with any prediction and anything I've said on the show, I'd love for somebody to tell me, to show me I'm wrong. But I don't necessarily see it.
I mean, here's the way that I see it. I think that I always think back to Leon Chow and the way that he covered Graham when Philly went up to Boston the 1 week. And had he had a better season offensively from that defense, you know, from that D-line position,
they would have been much better.
They would have been much better. And I think that there are a lot of players in this league that you could say that about. But I still think that it's just a numbers game. And,
and you know, I'll answer the question a little bit differently again. I mean,
yeah.
Certainly, I think that there could be a defensive player deserving of it who could have a good enough season. But just in terms of how much exposure that they get and how much, you know, it's partly our fault, how much we're going to talk about them and what their numbers are going to look like.
Right.
I just don't think it'll ever happen. I don't think you could have a good enough statistical season to put yourself in that conversation from the defensive side.
Because I think that part of the reason why you were able to take the Eastern MVP last year is because your numbers were just so... Firstly, they were varied, which was nice, you know, to see. And, you know, if you watched your O-line, it was impossible not to say that you were running the show out there. And I think you could say the same thing with Graham early in the season last year, that he was the man for Boston, you know, in those first 5 weeks. So I think it's tough.
Sure. And you know, it's funny, if a team like Boston isn't so deep, I bet a guy like Hershberger gets into the conversation for MVP because that guy can do it all offensively and then is taking one of the harder matchups on defense as well. So I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to say and to see if we can get away from only focusing on offensive players this year because of the gaudy stats that can be put up in a timed game.
Well, we've created an award.
And see like the real benefit and how a defensive player can be most valuable to the team, like a true definition of an MVP.
Much in the way that the NFL refuses to give MVP to defensive players, so they created the Defensive Player of the Year Award. Our show has, to give a little justice to the defensive players, created a Defensive Player of the Year Award. Which, we recognize the value. We just, the numbers for the offensive guys are so, it's not fair. Just from the pure, like, objectively looking at the stats and, like, outside perspectives and watching the games, it's really hard for the defensive guys, just as it is with defensive players in football, to compete with the guys who are really, you know, everybody's like, you know, the offensive guys have the disc. You're watching the offensive guys.
Right. I mean, I think it's also, even, you know, I was always a D-line guy when I played, and I even always was insecure about that. I always wanted to be on O. You know, even though, like, you know, my coach would, you know, tell me lies about how, no, we need you on D because, like, when, you know, when you have those opportunities, that's, you know, what wins games. And that's true. But there's something about being that O-line guy who, when you're receiving that pull and you're the guy who is going to walk your team down the field, that's a powerful thing.
There's a lot of pressure on the offensive players. And in a sense, they really are the ones playing quote-unquote defense because you really only score in this game when you get broken or when you break, when you score on defense. The offensive guys are really trying to just keep pace.
Right. Yeah, so I...
It's a funny way to look at it, but it's...
No, it's true, and that's why Frisbee is... It can be funny sometimes.
It really can, yeah.
In terms of just trying to get those breaks. But I think that it's an important question to ask. And one of my goals this season is to make sure that I'm asking the right questions to coaches and to other players just about the defensive guys just as much as the O guys. Because like I know that you think that Smash and John Cox, amongst others, like on your squad, deserve as much love as you'll receive, or Faust, or you know, or Marsh, or any of those guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree with you on that. I mean, now Jack's in another category of player, I think, in terms of like all around can do everything for a team.
Oh, of course.
And same with John Cox, man. That dude can do everything. Just wait until you see what he can do with the disc in his hands this year. It'll be really fun to watch.
So I have a question for you, piggybacking off of what you said about Kolek earlier. You don't think that you have every throw?
I'm working on a couple throws still, for sure. I've got weaknesses in my game that I will not share, but I can, every day I know I can be getting better at certain throws, for sure.
We've seen the throw that you're working on, and I'm not sure how useful that would be in the game.
But not that one, I don't think.
The throw that I always, when I think of you last year, like when you were coming onto the scene, I think of that lefty scoober. Greg knows the one that I'm talking about.
I think you may be confusing the lefty backhand and the scoober that sort of...
I am. I'm mixing those two throws.
There's a game against Philly where you do two really awesome throws where you put a scoober from the left side of your defender to the right side of him, and you start it out sort of after the double helix and it comes back. And then you hit Dan Heyman on one where you just stand in the middle of the end zone, your guy overruns you, and you lefty backhand him almost from the same spot.
Oh, yeah.
That's what John's confusing. And you combined them and made them into a lefty scoop.
I did. It was beautiful. I love it. But, yeah, those two throws, I mean, that entire game was just a, you know, an exhibition, an example of the way that you're able to run things.
I'll tell you a funny story about that game that Chris might not know. I was on the sideline of that game, and I was sort of shaded over to the Philly side for a little while.
Bias.
As soon as you started going off, Billy started yelling, "I told you guys not to let him touch it. He's killing us out there." And that was really the moment when we all started to pay attention.
Right.
It was that game.
It was a funny game because, I don't know, there were times when they, like, I don't know if there was breakdown of communication for them, but they were double teaming me off the disc, which was like,
what? Very strange.
Yeah, it was really weird, and like I think they might have just had some like mix up on things early in that game.
I think they were supposed to double team you when you caught it.
and so we just, you know, we had so many smart guys on our O-line that saw stuff like that and then took advantage of it. So I think we adjusted well against Philly, which is nice because I remember playing against Philly the year before in 2012, and they just beat the crap out of us. So it's nice to get him back a little bit in the last season.
So I mean, I think that it's a funny thing that, you know, how humble you are, and how humble Alan is down in DC, like as a handler. I think that that's one thing that's
maybe he's onto something.
right. So. This is a question that's tough for you to answer, you know, bouncing off of that, but what has made you successful at this level?
Sure. I'd have to give a lot of credit to John Korber up in Connecticut, actually, for really making a change in my game when I first started getting to play with him on Colt 45. I had never played for any elite club team. I can't come right off of college where, you know, we had two guys who could throw a flick kind of a thing. And so there was a lot of, you know, do everything kind of idea in my head, and showed up just being like, I'm going to do every single thing I could possibly do. I'm going to pull the disc, then I'm going to get the D, and then I'm going to throw the goal to myself. Great, got it. And it's like, no, that's not how Ultimate's played. It's as much of a team game as any other sport, and maybe even more so. And it just, like, I think about football and how important an offensive line is to allowing the, like, big name superstars like a Tom Brady to be super successful, because he's never getting sacked, you know? And like, right. those offensive guys aren't really getting the credit. But it's so important as a team game. And that's something that John really kind of grounded in my head and was like, look, grab those one or two things that you excel at. Hone them. Make them your own. Make yourself so good at those things. And we're going to fit those into a team game plan. And if you're doing your job and I'm doing my job, together we're going to be much better. And it changed how I looked at the game a lot, and just how I prepared for the game. Gave me more purpose in preparing as opposed to trying to be like decent at everything. And then another thing, probably another person that I think helped me a lot was Ted Munter, who coached District 5 in our second year as a team. And he was like the first coach that I had who was like a very dedicated coach. And after one practice, pulled me off to the side and was like, all right, I get it. You're okay at this. But like, why are you doing this? And like pointed to one thing I kept doing over and over and over again. And I was like, I don't know. I can always get open on it. He's like, okay, I'm going to stop you on it right now. And like, he's a guy that's almost twice my age and like, stop me immediately. It's like, okay, I get the point. Now, what should I do instead? And he changed how I cut, how I move on the field, and made it very deliberate in terms of making moves. You know, it's making a dump cut on one step or making it on five steps. Don't make it in somewhere in between or do something weird and funny just because it's gimmicky and it'll get you open. And that kind of like hard work ethic also bled over into the idea of like do one or two things really well.
Right.
Together between John and Ted, they helped my game immensely.
So I think that this idea that, you know, conceivably every player on a roster has one or two things that they do extremely well, and that's why they're on the roster. How much are you looking forward to, and how hard do you think it's going to be getting all of these, you know, your roster has so much talent on it, but, you know, taking the one or two things that each of these players, you know, what they do really well and making that into a team, how long do you think that'll take and how hard will that be?
I mean, if we're doing it right, it's going to take all season. You know, I mean, we won't stop because at one moment it all of a sudden clicks and we score one goal. Hopefully every single time we score or fail, you know, as a group, we're going to keep getting better. And I mean, that's why we're practicing. Right. I said this to the team, and I said it to the coaches, just last week, like, hey guys, I'm so happy that you put together this roster. I mean, it's so cool that we have all this talent, but there's not a single team that's just going to like say, here's the game. You're so talented. I'm so happy you guys won the off season. Or if you could win an off season, like, it doesn't matter. Like we still have to show up and work hard and practice and win the games. And so it's nice to hear the hype, and it's a whole new perspective on this game that we play that is making the MLU really, really fun. But it doesn't mean like all of a sudden, all right, great, let's go to this game and we've already won it before we show up. So in practice, it's gonna take the whole season. And if we don't keep improving when it matters at the end of the season, like if we're in a Week 10 playoff game against DC again, which very probably is going to happen.
I think we both kind of predicted something along those lines.
Exactly. You know, if we haven't continued to get better, continue to gel and roll punches, whether it's an injury or a guy leaving or whatever, like, you know, there's all these factors that we can't prepare for, then we're going to be in trouble. So.
And going, like, you mentioned the hype. We wanted to ask you how your team is handling the hype and the expectations that this show has largely been responsible, myself, probably leading the charge for the hype for your team and John backing me up on it. How are you guys handling that?
I don't think Ben's head could be any bigger, so that doesn't matter. you know, everyone else doesn't even like Ultimate, so we don't listen to the show. But thanks, though. I appreciate it.
So you're not a fan of the show? You're not a fan of our show, Chris?
No, you guys are doing a great job. It's really fun. It's a really fun thing to hear. And, you know, all with a grain of salt for us because like I said, if we don't show up and work hard, we're gonna get beat up anyway. So everyone's still chasing Boston, right? I mean, we've all gotta prove them wrong by getting a win. And anyone in the league hasn't been able to do that, so we gotta try that this year.
Well, not for long. I think in about 2 weeks, you guys are gonna take them down.
Greg is still sticking with his prediction.
So it's on the two weeks topic. You know, we're probably less than 2 weeks out now. By the time this show airs, we'll be probably
really
close. 10 days from game day. What are you guys focusing on these last 2 weeks?
Sure. We've got half the team hasn't ever played with this rule set in the MLU. I think we're catching up a good amount of guys in terms of like how we can take advantage of some of the rules. And at the same time, just reminding all these guys that like, look, we're still just playing Ultimate. We know what we're doing. Throws and catches matter. We're trying different pairings of players that have never played together to see if we can get something out of it. You know, like I passed the frisbee to Sean Murray 7 times at this point. Like, that's not that helpful. You know, so we have to like get through all of those moments because you know, it's going to matter a lot. You know, there's nothing. It's not like we're specifically preparing for Boston or anything like that. I think we're really focused on us, and we're going to spend as much of this season as we possibly can focusing on us. It's the job of the coaches to focus on the other teams and to prepare us for that. And so as long as we stay on that task of us, I think we're okay.
We got one last question before we let you go, before we wrap the show up.
Yep.
This one is a lot for me. I coach a local high school team. I help coach a local high school team, and some of the players have some difficulty throwing at some point. They all listen to the show. They're going to be really mad at me. But you know, it's, you know, I can only teach them so much. I'm a pretty good thrower. Nick in the office would disagree with me.
Yes,
because he just loves to tell me how bad I am at everything I do.
Which is true. Nick is absolutely right.
But I think it would be interesting to hear what is one thing that you would tell young players, specifically young handlers. One piece of advice.
There is no substitute for touches. There's nothing you can do conceptually, watching videos or in the gym or anything like that, that can better improve your throwing than actually picking a disc up and throwing every single day. I was very fortunate down in Miami to be in an incredible climate when I first picked the game up.
Yeah.
And I could throw it for the 365 days a year, and that was awesome. And I did, because I was addicted as soon as I started playing. And so a few hours every afternoon, just because we were in sunshine, and why not? I mean, it's fun to be outside. Really helped my throwing ability and everything. And in that process, you know, I asked for one thing, but I'm going to give a second thing. Try every throw possible. Make throws up, throw thumbers, throw weird double helix hammers, throw low and inside, high and outside, throw every angle with every throw, because the flight properties of a frisbee are so dependent on release point, spin, and wind factoring in there, that the only way you're going to get to like really understand how it's going to fly and how to put it where you want to put it, like guys like Alan do seemingly every single time he touches it, is by throwing constantly and trying all these angles out. And trying things you'll never throw in a game situation. And like, I throw things like that are what you guys saw me do. I throw the stupidest stuff ever just for fun because I think it's fun to do that stuff. And it's helped my flick on a flat plane, straight step out into space, be better because I understand how it's going to fly in that simple situation.
Right. Excellent stuff.
Yeah.
They're going to think I told you to say that. I told them a very similar thing.
Oh, awesome.
Sounds good. One of my players is going to take some license with that and start doing some stuff I told him specifically not to do.
That's true.
He knows who he is. He's a big fan of the show. But sure. Thanks a lot, Chris, for coming on the show.
Force them backhand and let them all throw a thumbnail, see what happens.
Thanks again for coming on the show, Chris. This was awesome. Yeah. Hope to do it again soon. And good luck. Good luck week one.
Yeah, guys. Thanks so much. It's my pleasure. Keep doing the great stuff.
We love talking to that guy. He's fantastic.
That's awesome. I mean, great player. He has great insight. That was, I think we knocked it out of the park with our first guest, John.
Yeah, I think we did. So, you know, going forward, we'll be posting our picks that we've made earlier in this podcast. You know, to Twitter, to Facebook as the week goes on.
So you guys can follow along.
You know, tell us that you disagree with us. Tell us why we're not the most intelligent two guys in the world.
Send us questions. Tell us what you thought of the interview with Chris. If you have any, maybe let's get some guest requests too. I like having guests. See who people want to hear from. We'll do the best that we can to get those guys on the show.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, as always, you know, like the show on Facebook, on Twitter, you can follow us at John and Greg MLU.
Yep.
And, you know, next week we're going to be getting into it.
Yeah, this is our last, like, kind of fluff show.
Right.
We get into the real nitty-gritty. We're doing our week one preview. We're going to have to get really tight with this, John. We're going to have to start doing recaps and previews in the same week. We can't have a show this long every week.
I'm feeling jitters already.
I think we used our time well in this show. I think this is a long show. We know.
But
I think, considering the content, you guys got a little bit of a treat. I consider this, like, the extended show as opposed to the show that ran over time.
Right. But, you know, we are over time.
We are quite over time, so we have to wrap up.
Yeah. So
we'll keep you much longer.
Yeah, so, you know, as always, you know, this is John Phillips.
We messed it up. If you're still listening at this point.
This is John Phillips.
I'm Greg Fallon. Thanks for listening.